Arnold. Bring your empty carriers to the park and double your reward points from St. Arnold Brewing Company. Concerts begin at 6:30. Most street parking is free starting at 6 p.m. For more details on the Discovery Green Thursday concert series, visit discoverygreen.com. This is KPFT Houston.
Usual is Egberto Willis, and we're going to have an open forum tonight, and I think we're going to have a fun show. And let me give you the phone number, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. You don't need to wait for me to throw out a topic you want to talk about, but, you know, you can. So call when you're ready, call when you have something you might want to talk about. It doesn't have to be interesting to everybody. It can be interesting to you. It can be interesting to me. You never know. I'm sometimes surprised at the stuff that lights up the phone lines. Okay. The first thing that I want to talk to, I don't normally read articles. I might take a couple of lines or a paragraph or do a little paraphrasing. But this is an article that I'm going to read mostly in its entirety, because I think that it addresses, I'm going to say this with some qualification, a serious political and journalistic question that I think people are struggling with. There is fighting going on in Iraq and Syria. We've probably all heard about it. Everybody who's listening has probably heard about it. And the question is, what do you call them? Are they the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, ISIL? Are they the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS? Are they Daesh or Daesh or al-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi Iraq wa al-Sham? I'm telling you, this is like one of the most serious Arabic to English translation questions since trying to figure out how to spell Gaddafi. So I'm going to read the article, most of it. And this is from BBC by Faisal Irshaid. So one can hope and perhaps expect that he understands exactly what he's talking about here and will enlighten us all. Reading from the article, the crisis in Iraq has highlighted the fact that English-speaking governments and media organizations cannot settle on what to call the Al-Qaeda breakaway that has led the offensive by Sunni militants and tribesmen in the north and east of the country. I will now break out of the article for a moment just to say that we can't even agree on whether it's Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda. So, going back to the article. UN and U.S. officials have been using the acronym ISIL, or ISIL, which they say stands for Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. The BBC News website uses the same translation, but a different acronym, opting instead for a more common one, ISIS, based on the other widely used translations, Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, or Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Some have also started referring to the group as Daesh, or Daesh, a seemingly pejorative term that is based on an acronym formed from the letters of the name in Arabic, which in Arabic is, and pronunciation always a touchy thing, so just, you know, forgive me, Al-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi Iraq wa al-Sham. The root of the ISIL-ISIS inconsistency apparently lies in the Arabic word al-Sham. Al-Sham can be translated variously into English as the Levant, or Great Assyria, or Syria, or even Damascus. It doesn't have a direct English translation. The term al-Sham was commonly used during the rule of the Muslim caliphs from the 7th century to describe the area between the Mediterranean and the Euphrates, as well as Anatolia and Egypt. It was used until the first half of the 20th century when the UK and France redrew the borders of the Middle East and created nation-states. The term, the Levant, had for centuries been used by English speakers to describe the eastern part of the Mediterranean with its adjoining islands and countries adjoining the sea. After World War I, colonial powers understood it to be the area comprising what now is predominantly Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, what the article calls the Palestinian territories, because that's another one we all disagree with, or disagree on, and parts of southeastern Turkey. The term's colonial association means it would be unlikely to be endorsed by the jihadists. They would also probably object to using just Syria, as it suggests their aspirations are limited to the modern state's borders. Various experts have therefore said that the word al-Sham should not be translated. Members of the group and other militants in Iraq and Syria frequently refer to it simply as al-Dawla, Arabic for the state. Some Arab media outlets and politicians have meanwhile started using the term Daesh. It appears to have originated from posts by Syrian opposition activists and social media users. So, breaking out of the article, that's kind of like the difference between Saddam Hussein, which is closer to the Arabic pronunciation of the name, whereas Bush and Bush administration people always referred to him as Saddam Hussein, which apparently in translation is a little more insulting and can be a double entendre. Just little petty things politicians and diplomats do. Returning to the article for the last bit, Daesh is not an Arabic word, and the use of acronyms is not common in Arabic. Furthermore, the jihadist group objects to the term and has advised against its usage. I like that term, advised. So I'm kind of guessing, based on some of the advice that is occasionally given by militant groups, I'm not going to single out Islamic groups here, but militant groups, is that if you use the term and you're convenient, you might be targeted, as an example. So be advised, as they say. I just thought that would be interesting. I read that as a public service because acronyms are tricky, and I just thought I would offer that bit of information so people understand kind of what's going on. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We have open phone lines, and I would love to hear from you and see what you think of that article and whatever else might be floating around out there. Another interesting bit of news. John Boehner apparently is threatening to sue President Obama over his use of executive orders. So, Boehner v. Obama. Quoting an article from NBC News, Boehner paints the move as part of a constitutional struggle between the legislative and executive branches, saying that Obama has exceeded his presidential power by issuing orders on issues like the environment, paid family leave, health care, and LGBT rights. This kind of legal, governmental, constitutional question is actually really, really interesting. Potentially, it could rise to the level of a constitutional crisis. In some ways, the Constitution is vague, and jurists and lawyers and politicians and constitutional scholars, when they examine issues really, really closely, often seem comforted by the fact that some things in the Constitution are vague, because it allows some flexibility in the political process. it kind of greases the wheels. Now, I think that for Boehner to raise this as a legal constitutional question, it's actually a perfectly legitimate legal constitutional question. It goes directly to the balance of powers in the Constitution between the executive and the legislative, and to some extent it still includes the judicial because they adjudicate these things. I think it raises the question of whether the executive has the power to make certain rules in the absence of legislation from Congress. Now, of course, from the executive side, the argument is that the president is not legislating with executive orders. The president is citing rules that the executive branch should follow when it is interpreting and abiding by constitutional or legislative rules. So if this actually ever went to court, Boehner's lawsuit against Obama over the use of executive orders would clarify a constitutional question. Where is the boundary between executive orders relating to the enforcement of law and constitutional law, legislative law and constitutional law? Where is that line? Or are we in fact better off if that line remains gray and broad because it helps make government work better? There are apparently, referring to the article, which by the way was written by Luke Russert, Frank Thorpe, and Carrie Dan, the article says that critics of the threatened lawsuit argue that without a specific target, the threat of a lawsuit is little more than a transparent political posturing. And essentially what that means is they're claiming that the Republicans don't have any standing to have any kind of a lawsuit. There's just, in a sense, there's just nothing to sue about. Democrats apparently are pointing out that Obama has issued fewer executive orders than his predecessors. So according to the Brookings Institution, Obama, on average, issues an executive order once every 11 days, although in fairness, that average may be increasing since he is now issuing perhaps more frequent executive orders. Thank you, Congress. President Reagan, he issued executive orders approximately once a week. Obama's rate of executive orders is actually the least of any administration since Grover Cleveland. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting. This period of Obama's presidency with this Congress, or the Congresses he's had, actually set a certain number of records. So you have things like Obama, criticized for his vacation time, actually has taken much less vacation time than George W. Bush. He's criticized for the number of executive orders, and yet he has issued the fewest executive orders since President Cleveland in the 19th century, and about 30% fewer executive orders on average per week than Ronald Reagan did. You have this Congress competing with the 1948 Do-Nothing Congress, that they have done even less than the Do-Nothing Congress. So this is not only a Do-Nothing Congress, by comparison, it's a Do-Negative Congress. It's actually undoing stuff that was done. So it's worse than Do-Nothing. You know, sometimes it just pays to leave constitutional vagueness alone. A conversation I was having with Egberto before the show started actually is kind of interesting. I actually made the comment that perhaps because of elections and, you know, we were talking about parties and there's talk about maybe the Republicans may split and turn into two different parties, maybe conservative and libertarian, maybe conservative and more conservative. And maybe the left maybe should have Democrats and socialists or something like that, Democrats and Greens, whatever your personal cup of tea is, so to speak. I think in principle that's not a bad idea. I think it works better for parliamentary forms of government than for presidential forms of government like ours. But I think that in preparation for going beyond a two-party system, potentially, I think that we need another really simple constitutional amendment. Now, I don't know that this should take priority over defining corporate personhood. I think that that's perhaps the most important question of our time right now, that and money and politics. But I think that a constitutional amendment that would require that elections be decided by 50% plus one. I think that allowing elections, whether it's presidential elections, gubernatorial elections, senatorial, mayoral, whatever, I think by that allowing contenders to win elections with less than half the vote, sometimes less than 40% of the vote, is a bad thing. It allows weird candidates to sneak in without having a public consensus of at least among the actual voting population as opposed to the eligible voting population. I just think that allowing politicians to win by pluralities is a bad thing. Now, that leaves open questions as to whether you should have runoffs or whether you should have ballots with preferences so that you have what amounts to an instant runoff where the ballot essentially allows you to say, well, if it comes down to these guys, I prefer this as opposed to that. So you don't have to then have another election, which typically has a lower turnout with less dedicated, perhaps more single-issue voters. Just something to think about. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. We have open phone lines. Since listeners are essentially the guests today, it would be great if I had some guests. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. You can call to discuss anything I've brought up so far or whatever might have hit your radar screen recently that you would like to discuss. Egberto, when we were talking about the political parties and the amendment, what were your thoughts on that? Because you had some particular ideas as well.
Yeah, before I tackle that, though, you're talking about the issue of the Constitution and the president and Boehner, the Congress. I don't think there's much of a, I mean, I think the Constitution is actually fine there. I mean, if these guys think an executive order is just a clarification of or the interpretation of how the executive sees the law.
That's the presidential and executive position.
Exactly. And if for some reason the Congress thinks that the president is not doing his job, there's a third arbiter of whether that is so or not. And, you know, and that's the judiciary. But beyond that, there is recourse. It's called impeachment. So if they're really concerned about these particular issues, they can go ahead and impeach. The reason why they're really flawed is because all the subjects that they're wanting to accuse him for with regards to not following
the interpretation of the Constitution
or the laws that they've passed affect constituencies that's negative to them. In other words, they think on immigration he's not doing his job. Well, impeach him on immigration and your goose is cooked. The other thing is on the environment. They think when he decided that carbon dioxide in the air was should be regulated, well, try to impeach him on that. Suddenly you've lost most Americans who are conservation. They're concerned about the environment. You want to impeach him on each of these issues. There's a large constituency that they'll have to be concerned about. So, yeah, this is a ruse right now, and I get a phone call.
Yes, thank you. I basically agree with what Egberto is saying. I think that the law and the Constitution have now, I'm not a constitutional expert or lawyer, but I think that the law and the rules have been clear enough that they are the rules we have followed since the Constitution began as the dominant document in this country around 1791. So apparently for about 220 years, you know, we've been good. I think that the Republicans are making a fuss because they see their governmental role as obstructing everything that Obama and the Democrats want to do, and any kind of a workaround or what they perceive as a workaround, they prefer to consider illegitimate because by delegitimizing executive orders, they enhance their ability to obstruct. The phone number to call in is 713-526-5738. We have open lines and we have a caller. Marie?
You have to wait.
Hello?
Hello?
Marie?
Yes?
Are you there with me?
Yeah?
Hi, how are you doing tonight? You're on the air.
That's great. Okay.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just trying to be a little sarcastic here.
That's okay. I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah. what happened to all the protesters? Did they all get put in jail?
Well, which protesters are we talking about? The rights, the lefts, or the undecideds?
I don't know. Which, huh?
Well,
I don't know. You know, the ones that were protesting against the banks?
The Occupy.
See, that's what I'm saying. You never hear nothing.
Well, I guess it depends on where you read. Certainly, the movement does not have the public visibility that it had. But people who were heavily involved in, and there are still some Occupy activists. If you read in the right places, they do posts and articles and occasional little protests. But a lot of the people that were active in the initial Occupy movement have gone on to things like the Move to Amend, to define the role of corporations in American politics, and to talk about money in American politics. You have other people that have gone into things like the student debt issue, or the cost of higher education issue, or whether we should have charter schools, or whether prisons should be privately owned. So what you've had is Occupy has turned out to be something of a training ground, if you will, and a networking opportunity. I would have liked if the Occupy movement in its original form had been more persistent. I felt that they began to fragment their message, and I think that that's where they started to lose a lot of people. It used to have a great consensus. When I visited some of the Occupy camps, it had a great consensus between libertarians and socialists and conservatives and liberals, as long as you stuck to the key issues of corporate money, corporate personhood, and money in politics. As long as you stuck to those, it was amazing how broad the consensus was across the political spectrum. When they started getting into things like the XL pipeline and immigration reform, and those are all perfectly legitimate issues, but I never felt they were the core issue of Occupy, and I think that's where the movement began to fragment.
Yeah, they weren't really, like you say, they didn't really get to the bottom of the problem.
So, I mean, they're still out there, but many of the people that were in Occupy now have focused on particular issues that are meaningful to them.
And you can read about that on the internet?
You can go to places like the Daily Cause, where they have people that do articles on it. If you go to truthout.org, I think it is another sort of liberal website, blog site. If you go on Twitter, you can search Occupy, and there are a number of people who tweet about things happening with various aspects of Occupy. You've got anarchists who sometimes tweet like Occupiers.
You know, that's what I thought all along. They need a leadership. They don't you think that's what they kind of lacked, was a real strong leadership?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think if you ask dedicated Occupiers, what they'll tell you, and Egberto can tell me if I'm wrong about this, I think he was more heavily involved. The whole point of Occupy for a lot of the Occupiers was the consensus aspect rather than the hierarchical top-down aspect. And I think in some ways you could argue that was both a strength and a weakness of Occupy. What the solution would be to that, I don't know. If you went hierarchical, then I think you would end up losing followers. On the other hand, the consensus building ended up losing followers. Sometimes there is no perfect solution.
Yeah, there was just things that could have been brought out that even the occupiers were not aware of. I mean, there's so much stuff going on that they were not aware of, that if someone had made them more aware of, maybe they would have been stronger.
Well, what I would suggest, and I'm going to have to go on to the next caller in a moment, what I would suggest is if you have an interest in this, Google or search under Occupy. And I think what you'll find is that there are still a lot of remnants of the movements, and I think you'll find that there are a lot of articles about the after effects of the movement and how some of the people who were involved have gone on to other areas in political movements.
Well, I always objected to the fact they didn't get much coverage.
Yes.
you know, they didn't get equal coverage, and that's part of the problem.
I totally agree. And as a matter of fact, when Keith Olbermann was on MSNBC, I think at this time now he was on Current TV. And he was actually, I think, the first one to start to pay regular media attention. And that went on for like 2 weeks before the rest of the mainstream media began to pay any significant attention. And I think that that becomes a flaw in our media system, that, that we have gotten so concentrated now that a few mega corporations decide what is newsworthy, rather than have a lot of independent media sources, independently owned newspapers and radio stations and TV stations, where you have a much more diverse political opinion and you have much more decision-making about what should and should not be covered, which I think gives us overall better coverage. I think it was under actually the Carter or the Reagan administration, I'm not sure, that the FCC changed the rules. Was it Reagan?
Changed the rules.
Allowing, among other things, how many radio stations and TV stations and newspapers a company could own in a specific media market. And that is what led to, essentially, Fox
well,
the media
company.
Well,
that's the whole problem. It's the problem of control.
Yeah, we essentially need sort of an antitrust movement where the FCC would force divestiture of a lot of that concentrated ownership. I got to go, Marie. I thank you so much for calling.
All right.
Great
well,
questions.
It's been fun.
Thank you, ma'am. Me too. Okay, Doug, you're on the air. I appreciate your waiting.
Hi, how you doing, man?
I'm okay. What's on your mind tonight?
Good. Okay, I got a potential solution or method. I got the last caller says, well, we have many problems, which I agree. I agree, but the other side of the coin, we have many things going in our favor. We as citizens in a democratic country, albeit with problems. And, Clinton ran in 92, a very popular campaign. He talked about, people are working harder for less, the people that are playing by the rules, and that really struck a chord.
Yes.
But, in a sense, he really didn't do anything or could not do anything. So I think the general method, and this is kind of abstract, but I love the idea, the general method is on economics, especially on more middle-class jobs, more jobs paying a decent wage, we got to take a medium step, not a baby step and not a giant step, but a medium step and see feedback, then another medium step, see feedback, and then another medium step. That may sound very simplistic, but that's
it makes
not
perfect sense,
done.
Which is why it won't happen.
And another example, or this is kind of another thread, I think President Obama underestimated, to an order of magnitude, how much people, health care is already too complex a system. And he underestimated how much people object to, on that complex system overlaying one more layer of complexity. And even though he ran on health care, the campaign promise, but he fumbled that ball rather badly, and he kind of built an opposition.
Well,
I don't know. What do you say?
I hear what you're saying. I don't necessarily fundamentally disagree. I think as far as getting things done incrementally, that would make perfect sense. Except
that incrementally, people think that sounds like too small. Like with health care, we could have done, we're going to extend Medicare to every person age 40 and above. That's what I call a medium step. It's not a huge step.
Well,
it's not a baby step either.
Okay.
And then, he may have lost that in Congress. He may have lost that fight, but it's something clear-cut people can understand. You're for it or against it, and at the same time, you're trying to improve Medicare rather than this whole new system, et cetera, et cetera.
And that would have been an interesting possibility, extending Medicare to perhaps 40-year-olds or 50-year-olds.
And I knew a guy that, he has some kind of curvature of the spine. I don't know if it's scoliosis. Anything else. It may have been, but he had breathing difficulties, and he is more prone to infections.
Right.
I didn't know him very well, but we were talking, and he was dead set against President Obama. And
funny,
I didn't
isn't
anything, it? But I kind of thought, he's exactly the kind of guy, who should be really in favor of President Obama.
Pre-existing condition, expensive medical care, that's being
exactly
excluded.
Right.
Yeah, it makes no sense. But
it did make sense. This is what, in another conversation with him, he talked about how, that he has to do whatever he can. And it occurred to me that he's holding this whole thing together, that he's already dealing with, primary or secondary is already complicated enough that, President Obama's like making, you know, laying more burden onto him instead of taking burden off. And so maybe if President Obama had gone on incrementally, okay, we're going
to. Well, now hold on. I'm going to have to interrupt because some point we need to have a conversation here.
Right.
I think that when you talk incrementalism, you know, if you want to increase the minimum wage, well, let's increase the minimum wage incrementally. I don't think anybody is proposing increasing it by 50% overnight, but we need to increase it. If you want to talk about incrementally improving medical care, well, that might have been an option, except the Republicans stood against any kind of a change in medical care. And the Republicans, for whatever reason, maybe because they are more liberal, in a sense, with the truth, Republicans are much better at messaging. You know, so they got out the thing about death panels, and they got out the thing about you're going to lose your insurance, and they got out the thing that insurance rates are going to rise so that nobody can afford them. And most of these things were anywhere from distortions to lies, outright, bald-faced lies. So when you're faced with that, you know, you talk about Obama should have done this and Obama should have done that. And that's because we think of a presidency as like being an imperial presidency.
But he could have done a better job. And we might disagree. I mean, I agree with you that the Republicans play loose with the truth, to put it mildly, or they just have a very authoritarian worldview.
They do. That's another question we can go into.
But President Obama, like a good football coach, he should have anticipated some of this. You know, he should have set the terms of what's the conversation. And even in the thing, like, you know, campaigns have a war room where you respond to stuff quickly. And I'm sure he tries to do this, and he's throughout run a very active presidency. But when they came up with that death panel thing, I mean, he should have embraced that.
Okay.
I mean, later did, where he said, okay, death panel is sure. They're called HMOs.
Quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Egberto has a comment he would like to make.
Just sure. A quick comment. Remember, this is important. Remember, every single president since Roosevelt has tried to get some sort of healthcare, universal type healthcare. None has been able to do that. This is the first president that put all the pieces together, and it's ugly. And the reason it's ugly is that these other presidents were not able to make those compromises to lay the groundwork for this monstrosity. Now, this monstrosity will get better with legislation. But remember, no other president was able to get it done. This is the first time in American history. That's all.
I think
Truman tried. I think Carter tried to some extent.
All the way back to Theodore Roosevelt in like 1905. I mean, literally, this issue has been kicking around that long.
One thing I will
agree with you on that was within Obama's power, and I think a lot of people feel this way, is that he let the debate go on too long without his personal involvement. And that absence of a presidential voice in the discussion is what allowed the Republicans to create that summer of 2009 hatred against Obamacare. Now, here's an interesting statistical fact. When you do surveys, you get people that are heavily against Obamacare but are in favor of the Affordable Care Act because they have demonized the term Obamacare. Personally, I think historically it's going to end up being a signature compliment to him that it will come to be called Obamacare in a non-pejorative way, and the Republicans will rue the day.
President Obama, to his credit, has kind of been good-natured, and he's kind of jokingly said, well, actually, the term's kind of growing on me.
whether he likes it or not, it's growing on him.
But one thing, like if we're talking about immigration, you know, if we talk about someone who works at Target stores, you know, and they ought to be in favor of progressive policy because they're a low-wage worker.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they might win the lottery and be millionaires.
Well, you know, whatever. But they're conservative in some ways. They can be mistaken on a dozen different factual matters. But we, just as responsible citizens, much less progressives, we need to try and find the kernel of truth of what they're right about.
Yes.
Just like I'm talking about the guy with the spinal curvature.
Constructive compromise is essential to good government.
And then I think that would bring us back to the point, you know, neither the baby step nor the giant step, the straightforward middle step. For example, President Clinton received a lot of credit for the Family Leave Act, okay? But that might be one of the few pieces of legislation he has that is one side of one piece of paper. It's a very understandable bit of legislation. And I would challenge you, as a pretty well-informed, well-educated person, could you name, or we could ask other people, can you name another piece of economic legislation President Clinton championed and got passed that is one side of one piece of paper, that's straightforward and explainable?
You know, Doug, I appreciate your call, and you've raised a lot of really, really interesting points,
thank
and I've enjoyed talking to you, but I need to move on.
I'll keep that out for thought. Okay.
Okay, call back another time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, next in line, and I appreciate both Frank and Don holding on. It is Frank's turn. Frank, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind tonight?
Hey, thank you. I'm just wanting to make a premise. I'm kind of in a hurry. I'm not going to stay on very long. I just want to make a premise, and maybe you can discuss it. But my premise is that there's no real difference between the Republicans and Democrats at the national level, that it's all a game, a charade, a facade designed to keep us all arguing at the grassroots level, arguing amongst ourselves so that we can't actually do anything about all the corruption that really is in control. I mean, when we look at it, I like to think of President Obama as a closet Republican, because when you look at the so-called Obamacare, but the health care, it's actually Romneycare in disguise,
yes.
Or Romneycare,
because that's what he could get passed
for a national audience. And then we look at other things such as the bailout. Republicans started it. The Democrat president continued it. Iraq and Afghanistan, Republicans started it. Democrats continued it, and then they're going to continue to get some more. The Obamacare's payroll tax deduction. Now, he had the authority to do that. He did a 3% cut in Social Security taxes. Now, who actually wants to destroy Social Security? Not the Democrats. Why would a Democrat do that? He could have done that with the income tax, a 3% holiday on income tax for a year or two. But instead, he did it with Social Security taxes, which meant $95 billion a year that did not go into the Social Security fund, which actually is only going to make the Social Security fund run short sooner. So when you look at a lot of the things that President Obama has done and the Democrats together, when you stop playing the game of Republican versus Democrat, when you look at that, you see that they're all working together for the super rich. The health care law is more about paying off the super rich insurance corporations than it really is about giving anyone any health care, because the actual poor people who can't afford a policy, they still don't have health care. The people who have health care are the people who can spend money and then, if necessary, get a subsidy of taxpayer dollars. And where does the money all go? It goes to insurance companies. If we were truly caring about health care, we would have simply made a one-payer, one-controller system that would have taken the same money and done a lot better. In fact, that's what was originally discussed in the beginning, was to cut the insurance companies out and use those savings to make it a less expensive system. Because insurance companies require a profit, and there's a huge profit in there, and so on like that. So when you look at a lot of things that are going on, there's a matter of Republicans and Democrats doing the same thing. So I'm going to let you go, and thanks a lot.
Thank you, Frank. You make a lot of interesting points, and I think that a lot of your points are at least partially correct, at least partially correct. In some cases, entirely correct, but at least partially. I think, first of all, when you say that both parties are the same, and you talk about they work together in order to do these things that many progressives disagree with or don't like the way they turned out, that raises the question of whether working together equals being the same. Because in order to get legislation passed in a democratic form of government, whether parliamentary or executive or whatever, you need to achieve enough consensus to pass rules and legislation. So very often politicians have to accept things they don't like in order to get other things that they want, that the alternative is nothing at all. So working together is not necessarily a bad thing when it's done constructively. You mentioned about the payroll tax and Social Security. Actually, that's a really interesting question because President Roosevelt and his labor secretary, and I cannot remember her name, but she's a famous individual, very critical in terms of a lot of New Deal legislation. And the reason that they made that a essentially regressive flat tax and that they made it a separate part of government taxation so it didn't come out of the general fund was because they wanted to make sure that the Social Security tax was not considered an entitlement, but was considered an earned benefit. The term entitlement is a misnomer constructed by Republicans to make it sound like it's something we're giving to people. And the whole point of making a flat payroll tax, as regressive as it is, was that that claim would never be legitimized, that the payroll tax is intended, is constructed the way it is, so that Social Security is not an entitlement. It is an earned benefit that people pay into. So, I mean, again, there's a lot of truth and accuracy in what you say, but some of the things that you raise, there are more complexities to them that I think need to be addressed. Egberto, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mostly agree with the caller that there are large portions of the Democratic Party that are just as bad as the centrist portion of the Republican Party.
Yeah, the money thing.
Right. And these are the guys that are that I call the plutocracy or these are the guys who are sustain the plutocracy. Now, there's the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, which is what this young man who called before envisioned, and that is what I think a lot of people should be striving for, the ones that have the real progressive values that are striving to do things that are for the middle class. Now, he complained about what the president did. Now, I think it is time that the population in general start to take some responsibility here. I think we have to be less gullible.
Are you talking about the 35% to 75% that don't vote have to take responsibility?
And the ones that vote as well, because sometimes the ones that vote might as well they didn't vote, you know? So, I mean,
you've got the dedicated and the single-issue voters and the angry voters, and you need to dilute that very focused group with a big turnout.
And as long as Americans continue to vote against their own interests, these are the results of that. And the frustration that I think his name was Doug felt is something that he's going to feel until he engages and all of us engage to mobilize people to work on real policy.
We could talk more on this, but I've got Don on the line, and man, he has the patience of a saint. He's been on there for about 15 minutes. I just want to say before I address Don, we do have open lines still, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Don, you're on the air. I very much appreciate your patience. People have dropped out 10 minutes earlier than you've been hanging on, so I appreciate it. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, here's what I'd like to say. I've been listening to progressive radio for many years. I supported Jerry Brown back in the day. I got on the floor of the Democratic National Convention in New York City in 1992. I was coming home from work, and some guys who were Brown delegates said, hey, here's some free tickets. Get on there and cause a ruckus. So a friend of mine and I got on the floor and caused a ruckus, and we were escorted out. Against Pamela Bear Clinton. What's my point? My point is that in order to really, really change things, and this is going to sound crazy to you, there's going to have to be a real revolution. It's not going to be at the ballot box. And the one statistic that stays in my mind that I read on Forbes.com recently, this is not even on a progressive website, the only relevant statistic, because everything else is just chatter, is that 85 individuals, 85 people, 85 human beings on this planet control as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion.
I've seen that statistic. It's horrendous.
The world's population. Yep. That's the only relevant statistic.
Yep.
Everything else is chatter and noise. And Amy Goodman and all these well-intentioned people can talk, and they can write, and they can make movies, and y'all can talk, But unless those 85 people are rounded up and, like, taught to share like kids in kindergarten are, nothing will change.
That's a plan. We could legislate that.
No, seriously. There's 85 people on this freaking planet that control as much wealth. This blew my mind. This was on Forbes.com. This is not some...
Yeah, it's actually a statistic that's been knocking around a lot, and I think Bernie Sanders is the one that first began to raise the profile on that piece of information.
Yeah.
And similar pieces like the fact that the Walton family actually controls more wealth than the bottom half of all Americans.
Yeah, that's America, right. So here's my point. You know, I'm not calling for blood necessarily, but, you know, whenever there is inequality historically that great, you have a French Revolution, you have a Russian Revolution, and it's not going to take place at the freaking ballot box. It's going to be bloody. But, you know, the American people have been so dumbed down, so numbed. Who cares about the World Cup? Who cares about the Super Bowl? Who cares about
any of this? But the World Cup has biting.
You know? It's just, I'm just so ticked off. I mean, the other caller is obviously right. Of course there's no difference between the parties anymore. Obama's biggest contributor was Goldman Sachs. I mean, You know, it's like sometimes I think the people deserve to get screwed. It's like I just wish, you know, sometimes I wish that maybe I was born in a different time. It's just, it's too depressing if you really think about it, what's going on.
Well, I sympathize and empathize with much of what you say. I'll respond, if I may, this way. Revolution, bloody revolutions rarely end well. To the extent that they end well, it often takes a generation for things to sort themselves out, and there's a whole lot of misery and death and blood during that generation, if ever, if ever.
That's true.
Another thing I would say is, as a window covering installer for 20 years, I worked in about 8,000 homes. I've mentioned this before, but occasionally it's relevant and bears repeating. I worked in about 8,000 homes over 20 years. I spoke to socialists, conservatives, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, Green Party people. I mean, I had a lot of time when I was working and visiting with people in their homes, hours at a time. And oftentimes you talk. And if they are willing to talk in a manner where they can agree to disagree, you talk politics. One of the beliefs that I came away with, and I believe this very strongly, and I know I'm not alone in it, is you need, when you want to develop an effective policy, you need to explain that policy to audiences in terms that the particular audience understands. I am not saying that you should spin it in a way that changes what you're trying to say or changes what you're trying to do, but emphasize the aspects of a program or a plan that resonate with your audience. So, for example, when you're talking to Democrats and liberals and socialists, very often it's a matter of the good of the people, helping the poor, helping people earn a working wage, that nobody with a full-time job should have to live in poverty or be homeless. And when you're talking to progressives, very often the tack you take is, we should do this because it's the right thing. We should do this because it's the necessary thing. We should do this because it's the human thing. When you talk to conservatives, and conservatives don't get too mad at me because I know that painting everybody with the same brush isn't fair, but as a general rule, when you're talking to conservatives, these people tend to be much more self-concerned. They tend to be much more into principle. In principle, people should be able to earn what they deserve, and if they don't deserve it and they don't earn it, then that's their problem. Or, I don't want anybody taking anything from me that I worked for, let them work for it. Or, if we do this, if it doesn't help me, will it at least not hurt me? So conservatives, as a rule, tend to be much more inwardly focused, much more self-concerned. I will use that term rather than self-serving. So one of the arguments that I have occasionally used, and occasionally with good effect, is you may not agree with welfare. You may not agree with food stamps. You may not agree with unemployment insurance or a lot of these other social safety net programs and social bootstrap programs. But what's the alternative? The alternative is that if you didn't have these safety programs, these safety net programs, people would be living under bridges. People would be living in cardboard boxes. people would be dying of starvation. Children would be dying of malnutrition and disease. Now, a conservative may feel like, from a social Darwin standpoint, that's what they deserve. If they deserved better, they would have better. My argument to them is, but that's not history work. That's not how history works out. History works out that the majority of people, who tend to be the ones that are poor and hungry and sick, eventually decide we've had enough. I would rather die on my feet than live on my knees. You have revolutions. People die. It goes on into chaos. Usually the results are very poor. So to make a long story a little bit shorter, what I then propose is if you can't see it as doing the right thing, see it as a matter of life insurance. You're not paying for Social Security and food stamps and unemployment out of the goodness of your heart, but think of it as keeping the poor and the oppressed, or people that perceive themselves that way, keeping them in enough food and shelter and medical care that they don't come over and slit your throat and empty your house.
Right.
Now, that's a cold-blooded, harsh way of putting it. But you can look at it that way, and it makes absolutely perfect sense. The rich should pay more taxes if for absolutely no other reason as a matter of life insurance. The rich now are complaining about how they are being so ostracized and they're being so criticized and they feel like they're hated. And you know what? So pay some life insurance. Give some people a break.
That's a great analogy, but you know what I'd like to counter that with?
Okay.
I'd like to collect on the death benefit and, you know, be the beneficiary. Because I just think they're not going to change. I think it's getting worse. I think history is a pendulum that, like, you look at John D. Rockefeller, okay? John D. Rockefeller, the patriarch, was a greedy SOB who got alopecia, right? Lost hair all over his body because he was exposed to the press, because we had a press back then that actually did its job, right? But
and
his son repented, right? His son, Junior, actually did do some social good, in my opinion, right?
Yeah.
So in other words, the pendulum can swing even in one generation.
Yes.
But it's getting worse and worse, okay? These 85... I don't think they'd be that hard to find. And, yeah, they've got bodyguards and they've got, you know. But you know what? $3.5 billion can take them out.
Yes.
You know, I'm sorry. You know,
so they need to be paying life insurance.
Yeah, well, I don't.
I mean, call it whatever you want, but essentially it's protection money.
Yeah. I don't know. I just fear that a lot of people were duped by Obama, including me. I think Obama is... he's on their side, my friend. I don't think he's really.
I sympathize, but there's also the expression that politics is the art of the possible. And when people voted in a Republican Congress 2 years into his first term, the possible became less.
Yeah, but
if elections didn't matter and if votes didn't matter, the Republicans wouldn't be so interested in voter suppression. Elections matter.
You can't blame just the Republicans, though, for the NSA spying on Americans.
No, but I can blame the people that don't show up at the voting booth because maybe they've been suppressed in a variety of ways, or maybe they just don't care, or maybe they think all the parties are the same and nothing they do will make a difference. Well, not voting makes it not make a difference. If the
so your solution is just keep the social programs and as life insurance for the rich, but I want something better than that. I want better than bread and circuses.
Oh, I'm talking about if that's the argument that works on the rich, that's the argument to use. I'm not saying that that's the only thing we should do, but I think that that's a starting point in terms of shifting their perspective. Egberto, I think, has a comment.
Actually, I was so impressed that Doug spoke about bread and circus because
Don
about bread and circus because that is exactly what keeps us working right now. In other words, just keep them fed and entertained. We have a whole lot of bad entertainment. And we keep them fed. But, I mean, the other good thing that you said, there are three.
So e-entertainment is the opiate of the masses.
Yes. believe it or not, the thing about it is it is not the 85 rich people's fault. It is our fault because we refuse to do the necessary deep thinking. Why do the people in Kansas behave the way they do? We have as those of us that are activists or those that us, like you, Mike, we're here talking. We have, and by the way, Don, I think we have to give Amy Goodman a break because I think what we have to say is let's help Amy Goodman. This is going to be a long haul to get this stuff right.
And how do you help? You turn out to vote. You turn out to vote.
And not only that, but not only turn out to vote now, but you turn out your folks to vote to be, you turn out your folks that you want to vote for. In other words, how many people are willing to go ahead?
The conservatives turn out the folks they want to vote for.
Let me give an example, though.
Do they ever.
There is one young man. He's an idealistic 25-year-old. You interviewed him. I interviewed him.
Nico Letsos.
Okay. He put his own.
I have to have him back.
Right.
Have to invite his opponent to be here.
Yes, we have to. He puts his money where his mouth is. He registered to run against Ted Poe.
Yeah.
Over $1,000 or whatever it costs over Ted Poe. Now, how many of us are going to listen to young 25-year-old Nico Letsos, who believes he wants to make a difference? Now, if all the people that Don is talking about decided that they really wanted a change, they wouldn't go with the status quo with the old guard. They would try this something new. So let's not blame Obama. Let's not blame the progressives that are just chattering. All of us are chattering for a reason.
You know, you talk about people taking the path of least resistance. There are some among us who really put themselves out there, like Nico, who has paid the money and made the effort, and he's trying to do something exceptional. You've got people in Occupy and Move to Amend and other groups that are going out there being active, being on the street, being voices, donating money, donating time, and occasionally blood and legal fees. And those people are really motivated. But you know what? The path of least resistance, if you want to make a change, go and vote. What is easier? You know, if you take 5 hours or 3 hours or 2 minutes or whatever it is, early voting, usually you can get in and out in almost no time. Path of least resistance, people, go and vote. Don, I appreciate your call. You've brought up a lot of great points. I hope you'll call back during a future show. Have a great night, great week. Well, it's been fun. It's always fun. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM with myself, Mike Koenig, and my engineer, Egberto Willis. What punchy quote do you think I can end with tonight? Do you have anything good, Egberto?
Just bread and...
Bread and circuses. It worked for the Romans. It can work for us. Bread and circuses. The Hunger Games. Okay, we still have a minute. How much time have I got
actually
here?
You have a minute, but you have a minute to remind folks that they still have time to hit that tip jar on kpft.org.
Yes! There is a tip jar at kpft.org. You can support KPFT. You can support this show. I hope that you'll designate this show, but it all goes into the KPFT pot, and that would be great. It's worth noting, I was reading on the KPFT website that we still have a conditional broadcast permit because we need to repair a lightning-damaged transmission tower. We need some serious bucks for that transmission tower. If you're one of those 85 folks out there that has as much money as the bottom half of the world population, help us with a radio tower, would you? Okay, I think that wraps it up for us tonight. KPFT.org, tip jar, radio tower, now. Have a great week.
Based on the teachings and philosophy of Nichiren, the lay Buddhist organization Soka Gakkai International's philosophy is rooted in the concept of human revolution, a process of inner transformation through Buddhist practice. It is a process that leads each of us to develop our character and to act not only for our own personal fulfillment, but also for the betterment of society. Members, through their practice of Buddhism, develop the ability to live with confidence, to create value in any circumstance, and to contribute to the well-being of friends, family, and community. SGI USA Houston hosts introductory meetings Mondays and Saturdays for those interested in learning more about Buddhism. These meetings are free and open to the public. You can get more information online at sgi-houston.org. That's sgi-houston.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Don't think you can make a difference? Be part of an effort that can revolutionize the radio station you know and love. By joining KPFT's Sustainer program, you can support your station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a Sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our Sustainer program. You can also visit kpft.org. Make a difference today.